Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive and sponsored by SeeRadioDifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Colin Delaney. This week,
BlackBerry owns up to the wake-up stunt.
But did video blogger Blunty cross the line?
All throughout this, people were questioning my ability to be there at the right time, at the right place.
The Convergence Review recommends huge changes for the media.
The Sapphires make it to Cannes.
And in TV, even the rafters can't resist the voice.
For a show in decline, we're doing okay. Thank you.
Today's guest on the Mumbrella Cast is Mike Wilson, chairman of Naked Communications here in Australia and New Zealand. Hey, Mike.
Hello, Tim.
And also with us, Mumbrella's Cathy McGinn.
Good day.
And Colin Delaney.
Hello.
Now, welcome onto the podcast, Mike. So what's new at Naked?
So we're obviously in planning phase now for the new financial year. It's that fun time of the year.
Is that the sort of responsibilities a chairman has hanging over them?
In conjunction with some of the other senior execs as well. We have really had a very good year just passed. So reviewing the year we've had, particularly in Australia and New Zealand, and also it's the first full year of our Singapore entity. We've had a year that's shown significant growth. We've won lots of new business. And I think it's the year where our investment, both sort of financially and in terms of effort, in terms of the content side of our business, has really come to the fore. And it's a good week to be catching up with you, Tim, because this week is the Clio's in New York, which is one of the world's most prestigious creative showcases, and Naked's walked off with a few gongs there, so there's still a few more to be announced as well. So overall, it's a good wrap-up to the year just gone, and we're looking quite positively to the year ahead.
And you mentioned you've seen growth, and some of that came through winning new business. Is that the main thing that's driven it, or has it been growing existing clients
It's a combination of organic growth of existing clients. As you know, Naked provides different services to our range of clients, and sometimes we work with clients in one particular area, and then over time we can work with them in other areas as well. So it's a combination of organic growth of our existing client base, and we've had a very successful new business year as well.
Now, it's not that long, I guess, since your title changed from that of founding partner to chairman. How has the role changed?
It's a good question. Very much in the partnership structure, which preceded myself and Adam Ferrier, my fellow founding partner, had sort of similar sort of status roles within the organisation. And in the new iteration of Naked, along with Phil Hayden, who's the CEO, we've got much more defined roles. So
Adam is now the global head of BS?
He is. Well, he's always been a head of BS, as most people would know, but it's now been formalised within the organisation. So he's our global head of BS, which also stands for Behavioural Sciences, and that's very much a role where he'll be developing Naked's suite of products, which will be implemented across our offices all over the planet. Phil's got very much the sort of commercial responsibility and reporting responsibility across APAC, and I've got sort of more of a stewarding role, sort of culturally, client relationships, new business growth, those sorts of areas.
The elder statesman.
Don't go on about it, Tim.
Now, in terms of the culture of Naked itself, you know, sort of it went from, I suppose it's what, 10, is it? 15 years? No, it's probably about 10 years old,
it's
isn't it?
12 years globally, 8 years in Australia.
And I guess, it starts off as, you know, sort of the young troublemaker. You come in, you need your new thing in the market, and you sort of, I guess, a challenger culture. Mm-hmm. How has the culture kind of evolved internally?
It's a fair observation. We were kind of, we've always been considered a little bit as upstarts, and I think there was an interesting anecdote. A couple of years ago, we were in Cannes, as you do, and it was the various Naked office heads from around the world sitting around the table and just doing a little spiel on themselves. And when we went around the table and described what we were like as individuals, nearly every single person around the table had either been into punk music or had been in trouble at school for violent conduct at some stage. So there definitely is a a rebellious strain within our DNA.
And which of the two are you, punk or violence?
Well, clearly, I'm an elder statesman now, so I couldn't possibly comment.
Although I noticed your Twitter handle is CFC Mike, which presumably stands for Chelsea Football Club, who do sometimes have the fans do have or used to have that reputation for violence.
They do, but it would be a very poor journalism for you to extrapolate that particular reputation and apply it to me, wouldn't it?
It'd be good journalism to ask the question.
So to go back to your original question, yes, we have grown up a bit, we have matured, and we have to be, and that's the right thing to do. Having said that, we still retain our sort of infectious curiosity, as we call it. There's still an entrepreneurial spirit across all the leaders of the business. We still want to attract talent in the market that aren't comfortable sitting in safe, multinational, unchallenging roles, and they want to try and do things a bit different. So we'll continue to push the envelope.
Now, this week saw Naked's parent company, previously known as Photon Group, rebrand as Enero, with a central push to make its agencies more digitally centred. There was a press briefing. In fact, funny enough, the press briefing, only two members of the trade press actually turned up, myself and my counterpart on B&T magazine. So it was a little bit less formal more than perhaps you might have expected. But at that, I chatted to CEO Matt Malewish about what that means for Naked's positioning. Here's what Matt had to say.
Going back to you talking about Naked and their sort of becoming, I almost took it as a sort of digital consultancy. I guess I've sort of, over the years, seen Naked first become almost, when I sort of first knew it in the UK, I suppose it felt like it were, you know, very much it was about being platform neutral, but yeah, a media consultancy, I suppose. Then I sort of saw it here in Australia, almost kind of evolved to, started doing a few executional things, particularly in the event space. And then for a little while it was doing execution as well. So what you're saying is it's going to evolve again and this time become your friendly digital consultant. Is that a sort of fair?
I think when you look at Naked, three core markets of Naked, which is the UK, the US and here, in the three markets, it's in a slightly different form in each place. Mm. So here it is quite multifaceted. I think in the UK they did a merger about, I'm guessing probably 18 months ago, with effectively a digital agency called Hyper. So in London they're known as Hyper Naked. And with that they have a very strong digital presence. They got 10 people doing community management, social media, full time. So that's a significant number of people doing that. So that's really quite interesting, I think, in a what Naked will become sense. London's got some interesting markers.
And that's the sort of direction you'd be looking to take Naked.
In the US they were more of a consulting, purer consulting model, if you like. Yeah. I think the thing about Naked is Naked. Is a very strong brand name, both for clients and for talent, and they have, because they have come from a consulting start point, kind of shape-shifted a little to suit client demands. What they're very committed to is, as I said earlier, really helping clients navigate the digital landscape, and I think to do that, enhancing their digital skills and their data skills is very much going to be a part of that.
And as part of the offering, or kind of central to the offering, do you think?
I think.
In other words, where we think of them mainly as a digital player in the future, do you think?
I think Naked will always be a strategic consultancy at its heart, and have that sort of. I think they've got a genuine curiosity about how everything works and what's new. Well, they keep getting invited to speak at Cannes because they always have an interesting take on things, you know. I think within that, building that data capability and that sort of greater digital sort of strength is a natural thing for the time we're in.
So that clip from a couple of days ago, Mike, was me, as I say, talking to Matt Malewish. And that is one of the things. Naked maybe stands for slightly different things in slightly different markets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's always felt to me like Naked has tried to stretch to cover quite a lot of ground in Australia. Mm-hmm. And I guess the challenge is how do you cover all that ground but really carry on standing for something mm-hmm. and having a really clear message about what that something is?
I don't think that's necessarily as hard as it might at first sight seem. Naked in Australia has always been a business that's had a heart in strategy, but we've always executed as well. From day one, we've done experiential activations, for example, and in recent years, we've been developing content in other areas as well quite significantly. However, the notion of coming up with creative ideas that catch fire in a good way has always been at the heart of what Naked does, and we'll be focused increasingly on the science behind socially propelled ideas, understanding the digital landscape to the extent that the work that we do gets passed on, picked up, talked about, and develops some valuable equity for our brands.
But essentially, you always be at the heart. You'd want people to describe you as a strategy agency rather than a digital agency, for instance.
Yes, but I think it's very difficult when you start talking about digital as a separate entity, because you end up in that whole siloed world that actually Naked fights very strongly against. So we certainly wouldn't describe ourselves as a digital agency. And even though we might mean something by it, everybody else would then pigeonhole us as someone who makes banners and buttons and creates websites. Whereas clearly what we're about is providing solutions to clients' business problems in the world of communications. And by definition, they have to have digital at the heart of it.
So, Cathy, you and Mike both used to work for the Photon Group in some fairly excessive moments. It became quite known for its parties and its celebrations as much as anything. Of that time, very much two managements ago now, Mike, what are your fondest memories?
Well, I think if you're talking about excess, one of the Photon events, well and truly entrenched in the past, but probably quite memorable, is the famous party on Cockatoo Island.
Yes, that's become part of the mythology, hasn't it?
Yeah, and there is, I would have to say, some truth.
How was
at the heart of the mythology? Well, it was a big party, and there were casinos, and there were banknotes, and some of them apparently were real, although I didn't observe that myself. We had Ruby Rose DJing. Empire of the Sun performed a full set with flamboyant costume changes. I think the day after they'd walked away from the arias with a number of awards that very much put them on the map. So all of that would be great if we were a holding company in the full flush of great financial success.
Yeah, but what was the financials doing at the time?
Well, I can't exactly remember, Tim, but it would probably be fair to say that perhaps the state of the finances didn't necessarily brilliantly justify that apparent extravagance.
Cara, your happy Photon memory.
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't present for the last days of Rome, but I imagine there may have been some similarities. Mass redundancies followed by mad partying. Good times. I particularly enjoyed the rebuke that we all received by email on a Monday morning for the stiletto marks left on the Photon HQ boardroom table after a particularly raucous company meeting on a Friday. Those days shall not come again, thank God.
That was Adam, was it Adam Ferry?
Yes, I think it was. Yeah. He's light on his feet for a big man. So tell us about how the Steel Banksy idea came about. And was he open to the idea at the beginning?
And it's probably worth explaining a bit about what Steel Banksy was as well.
So it's a campaign that ran towards the end of last year. The very straightforward brief was about filling hotel beds. The client was the Art Series of Hotels in Melbourne, who've got three great hotels for anybody who hasn't stayed in one of them.
So this is the Blackman, the Cullen. And the Olsen, is
the Olsen and the Cullen.
Good hotels.
Yeah, fantastic hotels.
Stayed in the Blackman when I was at the MasterChef launch last week, actually.
You are a media tar.
I think I've been in all of them, actually.
And essentially, the what's interesting about the idea is that it actually came from one of our communication strategists, came up with the concept, and then as an illustration of the way that we work at Naked, it was very much sort of a hybrid effort between sort of creative thinkers, communication thinkers, to bring the communication strategy together with a sort of the creative
spark. And explain the concept.
So the concept was essentially that we bought an authentic Banksy painting, and the idea was that if you booked a night in the hotel where the Banksy was stationed, you were successfully devious enough to make off with it and steal it. If you could do that, you could keep it. And the campaign was very successful. fundamentally, in terms of the client metrics, in terms of the number of rooms that were booked, was significantly up on targets. And ultimately, you know, however excited we get about creative spark and word of mouth generation, it's ultimately about doing good work for our clients. And we did tick that box.
And have you put it in for a few awards and stuff yet?
Yes. Well, I mentioned that we'd picked up a Clio this week in New York, that was a silver Clio for the Steel Banksy campaign. It's also picked up a number of awards and other awards both in Asia, Australia, and on the global stage. And there's a few more to come, or certainly it's been entered in a few more as well.
And I seem to remember there was a slight little speed hump when about 2 or 3 days in, the first Banksy was successfully stolen by someone from a rival agency.
Well, I don't think it was a speed hump at all. We couldn't plan who was going to steal it or what tactics they might use, but we did plan for the fact that someone would steal it.
And it was smart, wasn't it? They pretended to be from Naked.
I know, exactly. They were far, far better looking than most. Certainly the management are Naked anyway, but they fell for it nonetheless. But actually, no, it wasn't a speed hump at all, because we'd bought a second Banksy in the full knowledge that the first one would get stolen, and that would give us a second wave to the campaign, which we did, and it was very successful. I think one of the highlights of the campaign was it was running during the Australian Open tennis, and Serena Williams was staying in one of the hotels where the promotion was running. She tweeted it to her followers, and I think she's got over 2 million. So and it got picked up, you know, as you'd expect. But it's an interesting case study in you don't need to spend lots of money on paid for media in order to frame an idea or a creative concept. What you need is a great creative concept that you know is going to be curated in a way and is going to catch fire, as I say, through sort of social media channels on its own merits. And that's what we did successfully, in contrast perhaps to some of the other campaigns that are current at the moment in the marketplace.
And we will get onto that a little bit later in the podcast.
I was going to say that it's somewhat unusual to hear an agency boss talking about an idea coming from one of the lower ranks, and rather than having, you know, the head of creative taking credit for it. Is that typical of the way that Naked works?
Well, if Jono's listening, I'm sorry, I didn't describe you as one of the lower ranks. He is one of our communication directors.
I take back the question.
But I think what's behind your question, Kathy, is a very good observation, because the very notion of silos in agencies, in creative services organisations, indeed in holding companies, is actually the very thing that holds us back. Because I don't want to open up the well-worn discussion about the fusion of communication thinking and creative execution, but the reality is the two have to work hand in hand. It's a great debate, because the creative agency say we need to bring it in-house, the media agency say we can do it ourselves. The reality is neither of those are true. What you actually need is a business model where the two skill sets, if you like, are fused together and allows you to come up with ideas like that.
And may I ask about the Banksy? You know, Banksy's known for being tricky at times. And did you get a letter of authenticity to say that this was a Banksy? And how do you know that the letter of authenticity is correct? Did you get a letter for letter?
There is an authentic process behind this, and we did have it authenticated. But it would be fair to say that we didn't personally involve Banksy at an individual level to endorse the campaign.
Okay, right.
Now another campaign.
Have you heard from him since those?
Yeah.
And was he happy? Or?
No. So in some of our awards submissions, we then said we asked Banksy for a comment, and then we ascribed a suitably Banksy expletive to describe it.
And was that a genuine comment? for the tape, the witness shook his head. Now, another campaign, the Share a Coat campaign, which we really liked on Umbrella last year. We kind of named Coke as our advertiser of the year. Naked was involved in that campaign. Yep. What was the sort of gestation of that?
So the great thing, I mean, obviously Coke's a long-standing client of Naked, and we work with them fundamentally in a communication strategy function. The campaign was about, as a reappraisal brief for teens, and it was about the role of Coca-Cola being at the heart of the social engagement that teens have amongst themselves. So Naked's role was very much to come up with the concept of sharing, so that teens would buy it for someone else. But it's really, really important to say that Naked works very, very collaboratively with a collegiate group of agencies. So Ogilvy were the creative agency who had the idea of putting names on cans. So it's very important that, you know, it's clear. Icon were very much the agency that disseminated sort of the media and the touch points and managed that. And Naked's role was to come up with a strategy that made sure that the notion of sharing a Coke was very much at the fore and was in all the relevant places that it should be, and generated the right conversations around
and
that.
And why do you think the conversation was so big around it?
Well, I think, I'm stating the obvious, but Coke's a hugely iconic, extremely popular with equity, both overt and latent. And a lot of what we did was about unleashing a lot of that sort of latent equity as well. So I think everybody loves Coca-Cola in that target market, in that constituency. And it was about getting people to give something really, really powerful to talk about.
Now, if memory serves, Cathy, and it may have been before you joined us, I think you wrote a guest post for us on digital opportunities that, if someone was to do something about this, you know, next time might be available in terms of buying search terms and those sort of things.
Right, yeah, I think I did just make the point that perhaps there were some bits of the digital puzzle, some pieces that were missing. I suppose just in terms of, because so much traffic ended up going to Mumbrella with endless comments from people demanding that Charisse be put on a Coke can.
Yes, we would often get 100 comments from muggles who we don't normally get on the website.
Essentially, that was because there was no other repository for search, you know, other than bought search terms. There wasn't a sort of a web page that was optimised for that kind of traffic to go to. And I think that was maybe a missed opportunity.
Well, you know, it's always good to sort of look back on these massive campaigns
and
pick holes in one of the most successful campaigns in the history.
Actually, it's like Fraser.
Just on that point, I was looking at your case study today. Well, not Naked's case study, but the entire campaign case study, and I saw that the sales uplift figures amongst young people was 7%. Mm-hmm. Was that on par with the objective of the campaign?
People who worked in that category would know that's a phenomenally successful number for, you know, such a high volume brand.
And going back to your previous point on picking holes, like Fraser Crane says, there's one thing better than having an absolutely perfect meal is going to a perfect meal apart from one small flaw that you can pick at all night. Yes.
Well, you know, it's part of our job and any other decent agency worth its salt to review all activity and always see how things can be optimised for next time round. And we're currently working on next summer's campaign and very excited about it with other agencies as
What's
well.
What's next so, year's campaign?
Well, obviously, I'm not going to tell you that.
Any teasers?
Next, the wake up controversy.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Micro Citizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona, and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
This week saw BlackBerry admit it was behind the Wake Up campaign that saw stunts at Sydney and Melbourne landmarks, including the Apple Store, Martin Place, behind Seven Sunrise Set and Bondi Iceberg's pool. The brand has said all will be revealed on May 7th. Mike, you alluded to it earlier, I believe. What did you think of the campaign overall?
I think if anyone's working in education, teaching people about...
Or construction.
Yes. Apologies for recording this in a dentist's.
I think if you were currently lecturing in sort of the modern communications marketplace to aspiring students, I think there's some elements in this campaign which you'd hold up as being really, really good and, you know, sort of best in class. And there are probably some other areas where there could be some room for improvement, let's say. So, for example, I think the actual tease activity, if you want to call it that, so the sort of the big launch and the wake-up messages and the bottom of the icebergs and buses and flash mobs and so forth was very, very well executed. Certainly got people intrigued, which essentially is what teasers are there to do, and generated a lot of conversation. But if you park that, I think where it falls down, well, one of the areas where it falls out down, so I don't think that was been particularly well constructed within what I'd call a communication strategy framework. So the notion that you would go out with a load of messages, get people talking, and then not reveal for several weeks later, to me, is probably something you would have done in the pre-digital age. And I think that would have been the sort of thing you would have put together probably 10, 15 years ago. And I can almost see the block plan in the client presentation, which says, you know, day one we'll launch with all these funky stunt things, and then we'll create intrigue and generate word of mouth, and then 3 weeks later we'll go out with a big reveal. The world doesn't work like that anymore. It's not a linear communication channel model. It's something that has to happen with a great degree of simultaneity. I think the fact that it's...
Sorry, give me that word again.
I can't say it twice, Tim. Simultaneity? No good?
Well, I wasn't sure that you're going simultaneous or spontaneity.
There you go. It's all about fusion.
You heard it here first.
But the point I'm making, particularly if you're working in the technology category, you have to expect people are going to want to talk about it, want to be in the know, going to push the message instantly. And the notion that you've actually come out as a business and talked about your teaser before the reveal, it seems to me to be a little bit incongruous.
Yeah, I think Ferrier's point about why Kony was a bit of a failure was that there was too long a lag time between sort of activation and result.
You know, there's lots of buzzwords, as we all know, in our industry, but I think at the moment people need to be talking about real time. Mm-hmm. Now, real time media, real time messaging, real time creative, and the concept that people would get all excited on a particular day around a message, particularly in the technology category, and then sit back and wait for 2 weeks until the business deigned to reveal the next stage, I think is a little bit misguided. So I think brilliant experiential execution, somewhat questionable communication strategy.
Meanwhile, it was Samsung that got onto Seven Sunrise, and will BlackBerry get invited back 2 weeks later, sort of thing?
I don't know.
Tim, what did you think of the whole campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of with Mike. It's also worth, in microcosm, it says a lot about how media coverage works now, particularly when it crosses from social media to mainstream. We should put our hands up. You know, we wrote a story pinning our flag to the mast that we thought it was a Samsung campaign initially. So the way that The way this kind of entered, or our part in helping this enter the sort of media domain, was I saw the wake up teaser ads on a couple of websites on, I think it was Anzac Day, went and had a quick look at a quick look up of who had the URL registered, and saw that it was registered to New Dialogue, which is what was the agency that preceded Tongue. So that kind of told me fairly quickly that Tongue was behind it. Then I just so happened to see on the same day a news story on the dailymail.co.uk website about a mysterious countdown website which was linked to Samsung and was also counting down, very similar execution, although it was actually running a couple of days ahead of the other one. But that certainly sort of pointed it towards Samsung. And then about the time later that evening, I think it was, the guys behind Bannerblog tweeted about it and, you know, tweeted me and said, what do you reckon it is? So I sort of put out there my guess at Samsung at that point. And then the next morning we did a story with the suggestion that probably it was Samsung. By that point we were also, had beginning to make arrangements to talk to the agency behind it, but they weren't at that stage willing to sort of say, you know, publicly who it was. So we put it out there that, yep, thought to be Samsung. I think we also mentioned others had speculated that it might even be for the next stage of the NAB campaign or something like that, or for some, you know, new black product or something. Not making the connection with BlackBerry, though. At this point, and the other thing that Bannerblog had found was a video posted by video blogger Blunty, a.k.a. Nate Burr, who'd just happened to, or that was the impression he gave in the video, be outside the Apple store as the bus drove up and the wake-up protesters arrived. Let's have a little listen to the clip of what Blunty had to say.
Well, again, I'm Blunty. Now, here's the thing that's happened. I was in the Apple store having a poke around just now, like literally about an hour ago, and I stumbled across this newest Belkin live action accessory thing, which is this little boom mic thingy, which I thought was interesting, and I thought, well, I'll buy it and give it a go. If it's useful, I'll keep using it. If it's not useful, well, at least I can make a review of it and tell you guys it's useful or not useful. But anyway, so I'm outside the store. I unpack this thing, you know, having a bit of a play with it, pointing it at traffic and passers-by and trying the different settings and everything, and, you know, just playing around with a new toy, basically. And all of a sudden, a big black bus pulls up. A bunch of people dressed in black pour out of said bus with protest signs, and they start screaming, "Wake up! You know, I got all this footage of it and ran into the Apple store and filmed, and then they kicked me out of the Apple store and asked me not to film stuff in the Apple store.
So that was when Blunty was very much given the impression that, hey, you just happened to be there. People became increasingly suspicious, but not before that video went viral. About 500,000 views in 2 or 3 days as Apple fan sites all around the world began to comment on who it was. And it became a massive debate, firstly between Apple and Samsung, which is best. And then eventually BlackBerry finally kind of woke up to it and put their hand up to it. It was them. And then, it, you know, BlackBerry joined the debate a little bit. At which point you began to ask, well, that's a... was it just coincidence that Blunty happened to be standing outside the Apple store at the time and happened to have his camera out, and he'd had that sort of slightly kind of implausible story that he was just happening to be testing a new microphone at the time? He then kind of responded in a fairly unapologetic way, but yes, admitting that he had been brought in on it, and you know, BlackBerry had effectively put him up to it. Here's what he had to say in his follow-up clip.
Hello again, I am Blunty, and by now some of you will be aware that the other metaphorical shoe has dropped, re the Wake Up campaign that I presented a video on about this time last week, actually, and it's RIM that's behind it. RIM as in BlackBerry people. And I've got to tell you, it's been really interesting to watch this whole thing unfold, because when it first launched, people were like, And then someone reported that, ooh, it might be Samsung, because if you look at the website who it's registered to, it goes to this company who also did some work for Samsung and this thing, so, oh, it must be Samsung! And everybody started freaking the hell out and attacking Samsung and attacking Apple and doing this and doing that and basically being colossal morons and trolls and backbiting little bitches and just going crazy on the interwebnets, basically. And then someone else did some more digging on the wakeupaustralia.com website thing and said, well, if you look at this little bit of code here, that's the same as if you do a Google search on it, it comes up as the Google code that's on a lot of BlackBerry sites, so it might be BlackBerry, and people started freaking out about that. And all throughout this, people were questioning my ability to be there at the right time, at the right place, with the right equipment, and my camera was already running when the thing arrived, and rightly so, you should be suspicious. The most amusing thing of all about all of this is almost nobody fact checks anything. They see one person report something and went, that makes a kind of sense to me, it seems logical enough, I won't bother checking those facts, I'll just re-report it and re-blog it. It just spread and nobody bothered to check anything for themselves. And you, well, most of you, believed it. Thousands of you believed it. And there was one guy who freaked out and said, well, he said in the video he got kicked out of the Apple store, but then you continue to see footage of him from inside the Apple store, he even went upstairs. Well, I got that footage before I was told to get out of the Apple, not film in the Apple store. They didn't kick me out, they just told me, you can't film in here. So then I continued outside to film.
So that was Blunty. Now, clearly there's, Kathy, there is a sort of trust issue there in the... you know, Blunty is sort of, he's got his followers, presumably loyal followers who believe what he says. It's not journalism, though, is it? Do video bloggers have some sort of duty, ethical code or duty of disclosure?
Well, I think even if you took a sort of moral stance out of the issue, it's kind of an enlightened self-interest, isn't it? That if you rely on a trust between yourself and your audience to kind of, you know, if what you say is something which they believe, if you continue to swindle people, then after a while your followers and your audience will diminish. I think that's just logical.
His sort of argument in the second one was he didn't actually swindle anyone, because although he heavily implied that he happened to be there, he didn't actually say in so many words, "I happened to be there." So therefore, it was all an interesting... He's almost implying it was all an interesting social experiment. He's always going to own up.
I don't know. I mean, I watched the clip. I thought he was... I thought it smelled a five-day-old fish when I first saw it, and he implied that he was just happening by and happening to test out his new purchase outside the store in the rain.
Similar to Matt Moran just happening to want to support or wanting to go to Kangaroo Island and
yeah,
that sort
precisely.
Of thing, you know, on Twitter.
I think it's if you insult the intelligence of your audience, then they're not going to remain your audience for very long.
Mike, what's your take on this?
Well, I think it's
and I suppose if I don't point it out, someone will in the comment thread, you guys have previous when it comes to video bloggers.
Well... The thing is, you learn, you know, over time, and you know, I think we've learned some lessons as we've gone on, and I think there are certain errors you don't make in the current climate. I also think it's one of those grey areas, and you sort of posed it in your question about sort of what's the code? Is it a journalist? Is it a paid for sort of sponsored supporter? And these things are somewhat indistinct. But I think.
And in fairness to him, he still says he wasn't paid. It was just that he was brought in on the joke or the stunt beforehand.
And that may well be true, and he may not have been paid money. No cash may have exchanged hands. But the point is, there's still a value exchange. So he still entered into a contract in order to further his own presumably reach or reputation, and
not to mention the fact ads served against those half a million
well, exactly.
views.
Exactly. So I think the fact he didn't literally get cash in a brown paper envelope is kind of irrelevant because it was it's a contract of sorts, and it's fundamentally it's a deception, and I think people who build deceptive components into their communication strategy, you need to sort of stand up and deal with it. And I think you've seen a little bit of that in terms of the brand's response during the week.
Next, the week in TV.
This week saw Seven's Packed to the Rafters receive its lowest ratings in its five seasons. I can't believe it's five seasons already,
yeah,
Colin.
Halfway through the fifth.
The show is up against Nine's The Voice, which seems unstoppable, taking well over 2 million Metro audience every night. Rafters, meanwhile, received 1.16 million views and placed sixth. Anything over a million, I guess, is still a success, but, you know, Australian-made drama does come expensive. Colin, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where we kind of rubbed our hands together when we realised that it was the lowest that Packed to the Rafters.
No, we didn't.
Well,
don't speak for us rubbing our hands together in glee.
I didn't dance.
Well, I mean, I want to...
I didn't. I felt sad for it.
Okay.
I'm in favour of Australian-made drama, even if it is slightly populist.
As am I.
Not very.
No, you're not. You rubbed your hands together in glee.
Wow, that's the cynical journalist in me. But Rebecca Gibney, I know you listen, and I love your show. But what I mean is, but five seasons of a drama above 1 million in Australia is pretty good. Like, that's great standing. However, let's take a quick listen to the acceptance speech that the guys, Rebecca included, made at the recent Logies when they won Most Popular Drama.
And the Logie goes to Packed to the Rafters.
Dedicate this on behalf of our beautiful cast and crew to our families who put up with our sometimes stupid hours and love us anyway. And thank you so much for the support. We've been around for 5 years, so for a show in decline, we're doing okay. Thank you.
So that was Rebecca and co. Acknowledging that maybe the show was on its way out. Mike, have you known a show to hang around this long so strongly?
Well, I think... Again, there's almost like an implicit criticism in the fact that its number wasn't as good the other day as it has been in previous series. But I actually take a slightly different view. I think The Voice is such a phenomenon that actually the fact that it's holding up over a million is actually a really, really positive result. And we all know with reality TV series, you know, they will finish. But I think Packed to the Rafters, and it's easy to be sort of... a cynical media professional and say it's not for me, but the fact is it's a very well-made, very well-written drama. It's exceptionally popular. It's stood the short test of time over a number of series, and I don't think they'll be unduly knocked by the fact they had a dip in ratings when they're up against what will probably prove to be the biggest phenomenon in television of the last few years.
Elsewhere, on Monday, Network 10 came fourth behind the ABC in channel share, taking 9.8%.
And the ABC. That's why they call it Network 10, 10% share.
Where's the sad trombone noise when you need it?
And I'll put that in.
Please. The ABC's new Andrew Denton show, Randling, did well enough on Wednesday with a debut of 859,000, beating Celebrity Apprentice and Offspring. Mike, how do you think the three networks are going?
I'm not a TV buyer, so I don't have a vested interest in price or cost or any of those things that I'm sure Peter Horgan and James Parkinson and Harold Mitchell will be thinking about at the moment. But I actually think it's really, really healthy for the industry to have a resurgent Channel 9. I think it's fantastic. It's a long time coming. There's no doubt that in James Warburton and Mike Morrison over at Channel 10, you've got some very, very highly skilled executives as well. Clearly, there's a bit of a new phase for 10 happening, and no doubt they will be successful as well. I just think it's really healthy to have three competitive networks. There's always going to be some ebbs and flows. Channel 9, for a long time, have had to sort of sit and watch Channel 7 sail off into the sunset. And this year, it looks like they're having their time in the sun. They've got The Voice, which is going to be phenomenal for a number more weeks. That's going in pretty much into the Olympic Games. You've got The Block rating really well. So I just think it's very healthy. And that should only be good for advertisers and the value that they can extract from the marketplace.
And then they've
as
got
well.
Their pack to the rafters alike as well. Was it Tricky Business?
Tricky Business on Channel 9, yes. About a family of...
Circus performers,
that'll do. Debt collectors.
Next, the Convergence Review finally reports.
The government commissioned Convergence Review has reported. It proposes wide-ranging changes for the whole media and screen industry. Tim, you wrote the piece on this. What are the three biggest changes proposed by the body?
Why do I only get three?
Because you're verbose and we need to rein you in.
Yes, it is an 800-page report. It's weird, actually. It's about half of the length of the Independent Media Inquiry report, and I'd say that there's twice as much content, or that's how it feels. You know, there are a lot more recommendations and a lot more ground covered, rather than sort of there's a fair bit of academic discourse in the Independent Media Inquiry, which is looking at, I guess, the behaviour of the press, and particularly the print press. This is looking at, you know, everything from ownership to how you guarantee a certain amount of Australian production and Australian content on screen through to the behaviour of the press. So key things, creation of these, or recognition of these things called content service enterprises, which we might previously have known as media owners, but the idea being they've got to have a certain size to be classified, certain size being reaching 500,000 Australians. I presume that's in a month. Depending on what it is you're regulating, a certain level of revenue. In some places, when it's revenue against screen content, they're putting a threshold of about $200 million. When it's kind of, when you're looking for the overall measure, about $500 million. So, you know, around half a billion. So, these are the people who will be subject to the most regulation. They're the ones that people will look at when it comes to ownership questions. You know, who can own newspapers, radio, TV in the same area? Are there enough voices, etc.? And they're the ones that will be regulated when it comes to, you know, standards of, you know, behaviour by the journalists, for instance. One of the controversial things about that is that The first take from the Convergence Review is probably Google/YouTube won't be included because it doesn't have enough Australian-created professional content. I think they probably called that wrong for two reasons. Firstly, because I think that there probably is enough content that's getting dollars against it and it's just not that visible, and enough professional content at that. But also... the argument that actually, yes, they will have to regulate them at some point when they grow to it. I just think it's impossible to regulate that. So regulate the things you can regulate and leave the rest alone. And I don't think they can. So I disagree with the logic, and I also disagree with the conclusion they've drawn from the logic. So that's one point. Second point, there's certainly a lot said about promoting Australian screen content, and that's both in kind of on the production side, in how it gets funded, and creating this idea of a new kind of convergence fund that everybody, that maybe the government contributes to, possibly it's where licence fees, and there's a new licence fee regime as well, where licence fees would kind of chip into, potentially, but also people who aren't reaching their obligations under having enough Australian, spending enough on Australian content, they would instead be effectively taxed and would have to pay into that fund. Not much said about anti-siphoning, apart from there's a heavy hint that it thinks it's bad. So this is the idea that free TV has certain sports rights protected for it, so that it gets to have first bite for, you know, various kind of key sporting events before, say, pay TV can have a bite at it. So that and it sort of hints that it's uncomfortable with that and distorts the market, but then says, but the government looked at this recently, so we're going to leave it alone. So those are your three points, really briefly, and not in at all in a verbose way.
Should the impending election go Liberals' way, what then of the review?
Probably it dies. You know, it's taken most of the, you know, which is what happened under the previous government as well. You know, we've been a long time coming to this point. Or perhaps what will happen is Stephen Conroy, media minister, will pick the bits that he likes that are easy, that won't piss off the big players, and the rest will die.
Mike, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, no, I agree. Broadly, everything Tim said. I think the sentiment behind the report is very, very positive. I think clearly we need to have a body and a set of regulations that are in tune with the modern media landscape, including digital as well as the more traditional media owners. And I think this sets out to start on that journey. I think it's extremely complex and there are a number of grey areas. So it's not technically meant to be a regulatory body. I think it's more going to be sort of guidelines, but membership will be compulsory. So, I mean, there's a little bit of a conflict in that sentiment. And it's pretty indistinct what powers the body itself will then exercise.
And it almost washes its hands of it. Says to the industry, right, self-regulation, you go and sort that thing out.
But you have to be a member. So yes. You can't opt out.
If you're a content services
enterprise. So it's kind of got a foot in either camp, I think. I think the other fundamental issue is none of it might see the light of day anyway, because it still has to go through Conroy, and fundamentally what you're looking for is a Labour administration to implement it, and we're probably 18 months away from that Labour administration departing if current signs continue.
As long as 18 months?
Well, there you go. I'm being generous.
Next, Mumbrella at the Movies.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
It was looking like Australia would have very little presence at the Cannes Film Festival this year, but there's been some better news this week, Colin.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, there's obviously going to be lots of films in the marketplace. But actually, in official selection, up until just a couple of days ago, there was just one short film called Yardbird by Michael Spitzer of Good Oil Films, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago. But in the features section, the film The Sapphires, which is an adaptation of the musical, has been selected to run out of competition, which basically just means it's not in uncertain regard or in competition or in Critics Week or in Director's Fortnight, but the team at Cannes recognise it's a good film and deserves some love, basically. So it will screen on... they have a couple of midnight screenings, and this will be the second midnight screening.
Why does Cannes actually matter?
Well, it's one of the first film festivals, one of the oldest, definitely one of the most respected film festivals in the world. And, you know, it's just built up a reputation so that all eyes are on Cannes. And,
so it's a sort of marketing tool.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there is a film market there. I was, you know, speaking to an Australian film director just before I came to the podcast, and his film's going over, you know, there's a slew of Australian films going over in the market with their sales team behind them.
Mike, but do you go to the cinema often? What's your...
No, not unless it features animated animals, spaceships, or, you know, overpaid American actors voicing said characters.
Those were your favourite things, are they?
So, unfortunately, I don't get to go as much as I'd like. But I think, you know, any time that Australian films, Australian culture is showcased on the global stage has got to be good, and I think it's something we could do with more of, and I think we still probably punch a bit below our weight sometimes on the world
and
stage.
And Colin, Australian box office this week.
Yeah, so Australian box office, Wish You Were Here, which is the first film by Kieran Darcy-Smith. He's part of the Blue Tongue Collective, which also involves the Edgerton brothers and David Michaud, who did Animal Kingdom. So that film took $279,000 at the box office across 38 screens. It also opened on Anzac Day, a day before the official box office weekend, and it took it's taken $328,000. That was as of Monday. New figures have not yet come out for the full week. Also, The Avengers took $13.3 million over the weekend, plus, again, another $6 million on opening day.
Now, The Avengers sounds like that meets your criteria, Mike, actually.
Well, it does. Sounds quite good, doesn't it? But it I think Wish You Were Here. I haven't seen the movie, but I've seen the trailer. It looks pretty good. It's got Joel Edgerton in it. You know, it features a young Australian demographic hitting Asia, and hints of debauchery and drugs. So I would imagine most of your listenership, Tim, will find it very relevant.
I have seen it. I recommend it. It's a good tense thriller. Go check it out. Also, The Sapphires looks really good. It's got Jessica Mauboy and Deborah Mailman as part of The Sapphires, which is sort of a
girl
Supremes,
group.
Yeah, Aboriginal girl group plucked from sort of obscurity and taken to Vietnam to entertain the troops. It's also got the delightful Chris O'Dowd. I can't do Irish. Chris O'Dowd.
Oh, go on. No.
Don't look at me.
You're having a fit. I'm sorry.
Chris O'Dowd from IT Crowd and Bridesmaids.
Unfortunately, that is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to Mike.
It was an absolute pleasure.
To Kathy.
Thank you so much.
And to Colin.
Pleasure as always.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle pear.
So disappointed you didn't say, may the 4th be with you.